Picture a training field outside Fort Worth, Texas, 1918. The war is on, and the sky over Barron Field is full of student pilots wobbling around in the most forgiving airplane ever built, the Curtiss JN-4. Everybody called her the Jenny. Now one of those cadets is up there in the front seat, engine clattering away, and something's gone wrong with the radiator cap. Water's spraying back. And instead of coming down like a sensible man, this young lieutenant unstraps, climbs up out of the cockpit, walks up onto the top wing while the airplane is flying, fixes the problem, and climbs back in. His instructors were horrified, and then they were fascinated. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair, because today we're going to talk about the man who turned that stunt into an art form, and then into a whole industry, and then, God rest him, into a warning. His name was Ormer Locklear. Before we get rolling, a quick word about the folks who keep the coffee hot around here. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. Your first solo, your private pilot certificate, your instrument rating, all the way up the ladder. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. And every one of them tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let me set the scene properly. Ormer Leslie Locklear was a Texas boy, born back in 1891. Big, good-looking, easy grin, the kind of fellow who was climbing water towers and windmills as a kid just to see if he could. When America got into the Great War, Locklear enlisted in the Army's Air Service, and they sent him to train on the Jenny. Now, the Jenny is important to this whole story, so let me tell you about her. The Curtiss JN-4 was a two-seat biplane, wood and wire and fabric, a 90-horsepower engine up front that made about as much power as a modern economy car, and she flew slow, real slow, 60-70 miles an hour, cruising stall her, and she'd just kind of mush along and settle. She was patient with you, she had to be, because she was teaching a whole generation of Americans how to fly. And here's where it gets interesting. When the war ended in 1918, the government had thousands of these Jennies, brand new ones, still in the crate, war surplus, and nobody needed them anymore. So they sold them off dirt cheap. A man could buy a flyable Curtiss Jenny for a few hundred dollars. Some folks got them for less. So all of a sudden you had two things loose in America at the same time. You had airplanes, cheap. And you had young men who'd learned to fly them and come home to a country that had no idea what to do with a pilot, no airlines to speak of, no airport jobs, nothing. What was a fellow supposed to do? He'd take his Jenny, and he'd go looking for money the only way he knew how. He'd fly it low over some little farm town, cut a few loops over Main Street to draw a crowd, land in a hayfield, and sell rides for $5 a head, a dollar if times were tight. That was barnstorming. And Ormer Locklear was about to become its brightest, wildest star, because Locklear had that thing he'd discovered back in flight school. He wasn't content to just fly the Jenny, he wanted to get out of her. While she was in the air. When the Army discharged him in 1919, Locklear didn't hang up his goggles. He teamed up with two other pilots, a fellow named Milton Elliott, who everybody called Skeets, and another named Shirley Short, and they started putting on a show unlike anything the American public had ever laid eyes on. Locklear would go up in the Jenny and Skeets Elliott would fly it and Ormer would climb out. Think about what that actually means. There's no cabin, there's no door, you're unstrapping from an open cockpit in an 80-mile-an-hour wind. The slipstream off that propeller is trying to peel you off the airplane like a wet leaf. There are wires everywhere, flying wires and landing wires, humming and singing in the wind, and if you grab the wrong one at the wrong moment, it'll slice your hand or throw off your balance, and below you is nothing but Texas. No parachute. Let me say that again so it lands. There was no parachute. In those days, the barnstormers didn't wear them, partly because they were bulky and unreliable, and partly, if we're honest, because a man wearing a parachute in front of a crowd looked like a man who thought he might fall. And Locklear would climb up onto that top wing, stand up straight into the wind, and wave. The crowds went out of their minds. He did handstands up there. He hung by his knees from the landing gear upside down, watching the ground go by inches from his hair. He'd stand on the top wing with his arms spread wide, like he owned the whole sky. They started calling him the King of the Wing Walkers, and the truth is he pretty well invented the trade. But the stunt that made him a legend, the one that put his name in every newspaper in the country, was the one they called the Dance of Death. Here's the setup. Two Jennies, flying formation. Same speed, as close as two pilots dare to fly, one just above and behind the other. Locklear rides up on the wing of the bottom airplane. The top airplane lowers a rope ladder and it's whipping around in the prop wash like a live thing, and Ormer Locklear reaches up, grabs that swinging ladder, and steps off of one flying airplane and onto another one, midair. No net, no line, nothing but his own two hands and his own nerve, and two pilots holding formation so tight that one twitch, one gust, one lapse of attention would fold him up in the props. The plane-to-plane transfer, They called it the Dance of Death because that's exactly what it was, and everybody watching knew it. You'd hear a crowd of 10,000 people go absolutely silent, not a sound, just two engines droning and one man hanging in the open air between two airplanes, and then he'd make it, and the whole field would erupt.
Now, a smart man was making money off all this, and his name was William Pickens, Locklear's promoter. Pickens understood something about the American public that P.T. Barnum would have admired. He understood that danger sells and a handsome hero courting death sells even better. He booked Locklear all over the country, fairs, exhibitions, air meets. The papers ate it up. Locklear was pulling down thousands of dollars for a single appearance at a time when a working man made a few dollars a day. He raced automobiles from the air, dangling down and snatching things off moving cars. He transferred from an airplane to a speeding train once, dropping down onto it as it ran flat out down the tracks. Whatever the human imagination could cook up as a way to nearly die, Ormer Locklear would try it, with that big Texas grin on his face the whole time. And then Hollywood came calling. Of course it did. Here was a genuine daredevil, camera ready, fearless and famous. The movie business was young and hungry and it wanted spectacle. So in 1919, Locklear went out to California and made a picture called The Great Air Robbery. And audiences loved it, because for once the stunts weren't faked. That was really him, really up there. Really stepping between airplanes with the California coast 1,000 feet below, he was on top of the world. He'd gone from a farm town cadet to a national hero to a movie star in about 2 years. He was engaged to be married. He had money and fame, and the whole future laid out in front of him. And then came the second picture. It was called The Skywayman. Here's where I have to slow down, because this is the part of the story that every pilot ought to sit with for a minute. The Skywayman needed a big finish, a dramatic night scene. The plan was for Locklear and Skeets Elliott, his old partner from the barnstorming days, still flying for him, still his right hand, to put the Jenny into a spin at night, diving down toward a cluster of oil derricks lit up by big magnesium flares and studio searchlights, spinning down toward the ground in the dark, sparks and fire everywhere. And then, at the last second, recover, pull out, level off just above the derricks, and roar away into the night while the cameras rolled. It was August 2, 1920, out over an oil field near Los Angeles. And here's the thing about a night spin down toward a lit-up target. When you're spinning, the world is whirling around you. Your only reference for how high you are, for when to stop the show and save your life, is the ground. And the arrangement on the ground that night was that the searchlights would be cut off when it was time to pull out. That was the signal. Lights go dark, you're low enough, recover now. Ormer Locklear and Skeets Elliott took off into the dark. They climbed up over the field. They rolled into that spin, right on cue, spiraling down toward the flares and the derricks with the cameras turning below, and the searchlights stayed on. We don't know for certain why. Maybe somebody wanted just a few more feet of that beautiful, terrifying footage. Maybe a signal got missed. But the lights that were supposed to tell those two men when to save their lives, they never went dark. And so Locklear and Elliott kept spinning, waiting for the cue, kept spinning down into the glare with no good way to judge their height in the blinding light and the blackness beyond it. They never recovered. The Jenny spun straight into the oil field. Both men were killed instantly. Ormer Locklear was 28 years old.
And I'll tell you the detail that has always turned my stomach a little. The cameras were rolling the whole time. They filmed the crash. And when the Skywayman came out a few weeks later, the studio left it in. The real death of a real man. Up there on the screen, sold as entertainment, the advertisements even leaned on it. That was the world Locklear lived and died in. Danger sells, and the ultimate danger sells best of all. Now, don't hear me wrong. I don't tell you that to be grim, and I sure don't tell you it to run down a brave man, because here's what Ormer Locklear actually gave us. Every wingwalker, at every air show you've ever cheered for, every one of them is standing on Ormer Locklear's shoulders. He drew the map. And more than that, those crazy barnstormers, Locklear and Bessie Coleman and the whole ragtag army of them flying war surplus Jennies out of cow pastures, they did something nobody else was doing in those years. They introduced America to the airplane. Think about it. In the early 1920s, most Americans had never seen an airplane up close, let alone been near one, and here comes a Jenny circling the county fair, and for $5 grandpa gets his first ride, and a 10-year-old boy in the crowd looks up and watches a man walk on a wing against the blue, and something in that kid gets set on fire. A whole lot of the men who built our airlines and won our air war 20 years later. They got their first taste of aviation at a barnstorming show. The barnstormers were the recruiters. They just didn't know it. But there's a harder lesson in Locklear's story too, and it's one that never goes out of date. He didn't die doing the Dance of Death. He didn't die walking a wing with no parachute over Texas. He'd done all of that 100 times and lived. He died because he was counting on somebody on the ground to give him a signal, and the signal never came, and by the time he knew it, he was too low and too blind to fix it.
The airplane didn't kill Ormer Locklear. The plan did. He'd handed his life to a cue he couldn't verify from the cockpit, and he ran out of altitude waiting on it. And I gently say to you, every one of us has flown a version of that. Trusting that the weather would do what somebody told us it would do, trusting that the fuel was in the tanks because somebody said so. Pressing on into the dark, waiting for the picture to get better, waiting for the light to change, when the smart move was to break off the show while we still had the height to do it. Locklear was maybe the bravest man in American aviation, but brave isn't the same as safe, and the two got confused an awful lot in those wide open years back when Avigas was cheap and airspace was free. I got this story from the accounts kept by the National Air and Space Museum and from the aviation historians and the old newspaper reporting that followed Locklear around the country while he was alive and mourned him when he was gone. If you want to see a Jenny for yourself, the same kind of airplane Ormer Locklear climbed out of, go find one at a museum or a fly-in and just stand next to it. Put your hand on the wing he would have walked. There's more about all of it over at RadioHangar.com. This is Tail Dragger. Fly brave if you have to, but fly smart first. And don't ever bet your recovery on a light somebody else is holding. I'll see you next time.